On Tuesday, October 12, 2010, the Korea Economic Institute hosted an academic paper series event. The co-authors were Scott Snyder and Siwon Byun, and the paper was titled The China-ROK Trade Relationship and Implications for Managing Security Cooperation.
Welcome, everyone. I hope the majority of you at least had yesterday off and that this is your first day back. Those of you in government, maybe at least. My name is Nicole Finneman. I'm the Director of Research and Academic Affairs here at KEI and the custodian of KEI's academic paper series. Today we welcome you to our 38th paper in this series, which we began in December 2008. We're very happy. We only have, this is our getting to be the end of the season, so we only have two more after this in 2010. At the end of the year, we compile all of these papers into On Korea, and you will see Scott and Siwon's paper both later this week online, but then again in the beginning of 2011 in a book that'll look just like this, but it'll probably be bright orange like the poster was downstairs. It's a very successful series. We're very happy with the results we've had so far. We get people from far distances submitting proposals, and we also get people we respect quite a lot and need very little introduction for an audience right here in D.C., like, for example, today's speakers. You all have both Scott and Siwon's bios in front of you, and I am looking out at the audience, and I know most of you already know who they are, so they need very little introduction. When Scott and Siwon submitted this proposal to us, I do think it took all of 22 seconds to decide that this was not only a paper we wanted to do because of the topic, but because we knew the quality that would come with it. We're very pleased to have both of them here today. I won't speak for any longer. I'm going to hand it over, but I will remind you, for those of you who are new here to our academic paper series, we do intend for the program to be a discussion, and following the presentation, we will be looking to you for your questions and your comments. You will notice that today's paper is in draft format. Because all of you have RSVP'd to this program, we should have your email address. If not, please make sure to leave a card with us. And by the end of this week, you will receive a final formatted version of this paper, and we will have it up online. As you can see, this paper is not for distribution in its current format. It's just for your enjoyment for coming out today. But without further ado, I will turn the floor over to you, Siwon, and enjoy your presentation.
Thanks, Nicole, and thank you to KEI for organizing this as part of their academic paper series. You all have a copy of our paper, but our paper compares China and South Korea's management of trade and security issues over the past 10 years to show that despite close economic ties, the political and security aspects of the relationship remain relatively weak due to the lack of effective security mechanisms for dealing with these disputes compared to the economic side of the relationship. And I'd like to highlight four main conclusions from this paper, the first being that the Sino-South Korean economic growth has benefited from the existence of a global regulatory structure and as well as bilateral efforts to institutionalize cooperation to manage economic issues as they arise. On the other hand, the political security cooperation is less developed and dominated by economic issues. And second, future bilateral relations will require a greater willingness to develop stronger consultative mechanisms for managing bilateral disputes, which will present a challenge for South Korea in managing future disputes with China, considering the lack of the institutionalization of the relationship. And third, so far, economic disputes have been managed without any spillover effects onto the political side of the relationship, and vice versa. Political disputes haven't had any spillover effects onto the economic side of the relationship, although the recent China-Japan case over the island dispute might change this. And finally, fourth, the Sino-South Korean management of political security relations has been suppressed partly due to the existence of the U.S.-Korea alliance. And this is partly due to the conflicting perceptions between China and South Korea regarding the alliance versus multilateral security institutions, with South Korea seeing the alliance and multilateral security institutions as part of a multi-layered regional structure, while China sees the two more in zero-sum terms. So I'm going to go through three major bilateral trade disputes between China and South Korea to date, including the Garlic War in 2000, the Kimchi War in 2005, and the melamine scandal in 2008, to show that China's global economic integration, as represented by its WTO entry in 2001, provided external institutional framework for managing bilateral disputes, bilateral trade disputes, which has facilitated trade growth. And Scott will later discuss the political and security side using the 2005 Koguryo history dispute and the most recent Cheonan case as two case studies. So first, to give a brief overview of China-South Korean trade trends in my one slide here. As you can see, bilateral trade has steadily increased since diplomatic normalization in 1992, with a temporary slowdown during the late 1990s financial crisis and the most recent global recession in 2008. Trade clearly accelerated with China's WTO entry in 2001, after which bilateral trade has been increasing at an average annual rate of 20%, reaching $141 billion in 2009, which was greater than South Korea's combined trade with the United States and Japan. China replaced the United States as South Korea's biggest trade partner in 2003 and top investment destination in 2004, while South Korea is China's third biggest trade partner and sixth biggest investment source. Although China's WTO entry has facilitated a stable trade relationship, at the same time, new concerns have emerged with China's rise and opening, including competition in key export markets and technology transfer issues. For example, during the first half of 2010, China replaced South Korea as the world's biggest shipbuilding country and the biggest market for South Korea's own Hyundai Motors. And a recent South Korean report showed that South Korea might lose all technology advantages over China within the next 4 years in eight key export items, such as steel, mobile phones, and autos, which accounted for 64% of all South Korean exports in 2009. So moving on to the trade disputes, the 2001 Garlic War happened 1 year before China's WTO entry and was the first major bilateral trade dispute that required political mediation. The paper goes on into more detail about how this dispute dragged on for 3 years, but it began with South Korean accusations of Chinese dumping that led to South Korea's raising of tariffs on Chinese garlic imports, in response to which China threatened to ban South Korean mobile phone and polyethylene imports. This eventually led to an agreement in which South Korea agreed to buy Chinese garlic imports at lower tariffs and agreed to lift import restrictions entirely from 2003 in return for China's lifting of the retaliatory sanctions. So essentially, it saved South Korea potential losses in high-tech sectors that were worth several hundred times more than the value of garlic trade. And most importantly, the garlic dispute showed China's aggressive use of unilateral trade tactics in the form of retaliatory sanctions in unrelated high-tech sectors, and it highlighted the need for a stronger framework for dealing with, for minimizing trade tensions and for avoiding the related political risks. So, second, the Kimchi War in 2005 was the second major bilateral dispute that began with the discovery of parasite eggs in Chinese kimchi imports, in response to which South Korea banned Chinese kimchi imports, and China, in turn, banned South Korean kimchi products, claiming that they were also contaminated. But in contrast to the garlic war, the kimchi dispute was resolved relatively quickly through mechanisms to strengthen safety standards and regulations on both sides, and through intergovernmental coordination to institutionalize food safety procedures as part of bilateral trade efforts, and also through diplomatic efforts to avoid further escalation, as seen in the garlic case, and to ease nationalistic public responses. So the external institutional context provided a framework for inducing compliance with international norms and for minimizing retaliatory measures, as seen in the garlic case, and served as a mechanism for depoliticizing the trade disputes. And finally, the melamine scandal in 2008, which raised South Korean concerns about Chinese food and product safety issues that had emerged as a global concern that summer. But this led to not only South Korea's banning and destroying of Chinese dairy imports, but also the tightening of regulations and the introduction of new standards for other products like heavy metals. And China and South Korea also agreed to strengthen bilateral cooperation on food safety, including through information sharing between their respective health agencies, while also strengthening trilateral coordination with Japan through the trilateral health ministers meeting that was launched in 2007. So to summarize, it's possible to draw two major lessons from these trade disputes. The first being that China's global economic integration has provided a framework for managing bilateral trade disputes based on international norms. As we saw in 2000 during the garlic dispute, without a Chinese obligation to comply with WTO principles, it was possible for China to resort to unilateral retaliatory measures in the form of retaliatory sanctions in high-tech sectors. Second, the trade disputes also led China and South Korea to enhance their joint capacity in managing bilateral trade issues by both strengthening and coordinating domestic regulatory mechanisms on both sides, and also through new and existing forms of bilateral and regional trilateral consultative mechanisms in specific sectors, as we saw in the kimchi and melamine cases. And before I end here, I should mention the recent China-Japan territorial dispute, where China's reported restriction on the rare earth mineral exports to Japan, in apparent response to the territorial dispute, suggests that China's WTO membership might be an insufficient factor constraining China from using its economic leverage as a retaliatory measure in managing political disputes.
Okay, well, I'm going to take it from here and cover the security side of the China-South Korea relationship. But before I do, I feel compelled to mention, since I was last week in South Korea, that there is a kind of reverberation on the kimchi side. Everybody knows that in South Korea, the price of kimchi has gone up by something like 70%. And I think that this is in part related to decisions by Chinese farmers to decrease production of kimchi or cabbage for making kimchi. When I was there, I saw a visiting national assemblyman who had spent all morning at the market supervising rationing of kimchi cabbage, and his joke was that he thought that rationing was supposed to occur in North Korea, not South Korea. Just a kind of, you know, aside related to the economic aspect. On the security side, I think that what we have seen in both this Kogoryo case and most recently over the course of the summer with the Chunan case has been essentially a resistance to institutionalization in management of China-South Korea security and political disputes, and a tendency toward informal management. And so far, in both the Kogoryo case and the Chunan case, it doesn't appear that either incident has resulted in greater institutionalization of political or security cooperation. And then, you know, the other aspect of the argument that we are interested in exploring is that, you know, on the economic side, there is the WTO, but there really is not an effective framework in terms of broader institutional management of political and security issues that can help regulate tensions in China-South Korea relations. And the argument is that this kind of adds further volatility, or potentially to volatility, on the management of political and security relations between China and South Korea moving forward. As we look at the region, it's obvious there's not a a regional mechanism for regulating security disputes. CSCAP argues that it's not a lack of institutions. We know there's a lot of institutions, but it's the question of whether or not those institutions can be used effectively. And then also, you know, there's this, I guess, really dispute over future architecture. On the one hand, China in particular has been, you know, focused on the U.S.-led alliance network as not suitable as part of the regional architecture, whereas proposals from the U.S. or South Korea tend to, and most recently from Hitoshi Tanaka in Japan, have argued for a kind of multi-layered security structure, where there's an alliance component to the security architecture in addition to various cooperative regional mechanisms. One of the hindrances to the development of security regionalism that we point to in the paper is Chinese opposition to the alliance framework. I've mentioned that. And then also the bilateral relationship on the political and security side between China and South Korea. It's been very difficult for China and South Korea to develop a strategic dialogue on the really hard issues in the region. There is recently the development of a so-called senior security dialogue that agrees on the importance or priority of denuclearization, peace, and stability. I think they just met last at the end of September. But that dialogue has not been able to address the hard issues in the relationship post-Chun'an. It was unable to deal with any sensitive issues related to North Korea. Another area where we have seen efforts to try to institutionalize political and security cooperation between China and South Korea has been the establishment of naval and air force hotlines, but it's not clear whether this particular set of hotlines, even though they were established a couple of years ago, are really working yet. What I've heard is that basically you have to have some informal communication, probably via mobile phone, between the two sides in order to let people know that you're going to be using the hotline, which suggests that the existence of the hotline itself is really not an effective institutional mechanism yet for trying to manage any potential crisis. And then just as part of the regional architecture, the other piece I think that is interesting to potentially look at is what happens among China, South Korea, and Japan. And we know that they're having regular summits and that there is a document that was developed earlier this year that develops a vision for trilateral cooperation out into the future. But you know, that regional framework is still nascent, and it's just not clear what that's going to be able to contribute. So just to go back and say a word about the Koguryo issue in 2004, it was really the first major dispute that brought security issues to the fore in the China-Korea relationship. But there are some interesting aspects. And, of course, this dispute was really about, initially it was about who was going to be able to register the existence of Koguryo tombs with UNESCO, the Chinese or the North Koreans, but it was also stimulated by a project, Chinese-initiated project, the Northeast Project, which was focused on developing a historical narrative related to some of the minority areas in northeastern China and in South Korea. It was perceived as an effort to really undermine the claim that the Koguryo Kingdom, which is a big part of South Korean historiography, as being Korean. The immediate stimulus for that to become a big issue of dispute was the Chinese Foreign Ministry's decision essentially to delete the Korean history section as part of their website prior to 1948 as a way of trying to avoid getting into this particular dispute. It resulted in a firestorm of response, public response in South Korea. You know, one aspect of this particular issue that I think is important to note is that it was really asymmetric in terms of its impact. South Koreans were up in arms about it. The Chinese public didn't really know that there was an issue of dispute because it wasn't really covered actively in the Chinese media. A second aspect of this particular dispute that I think is interesting, and I've done some other work on it, is related to the fact that in South Korea, the response on Koguryo was really privately driven and privately led, whereas in China, most of the action and activity related to it has really been state-driven. But maybe most relevant for the purpose of this particular paper is that the way in which the post-Koguryo issues were handled between China and South Korea was essentially to develop some informal agreements between China and South Korea, in particular about how Koguryo would be characterized in educational materials, rather than having any kind of formalized or written response. And so this really goes back to the resistance to the idea of institutionalizing cooperation between China and South Korea. And then most recently, as we look at the Chun'an dispute, it's still kind of, you know, in process, but just a couple of characteristics that I think that we can look at that are related to some of the conclusions that Shiwon has already outlined. South Korea seemed surprised that its own economic leverage compared to that of North Korea, as it made its case related to the Chun'an, didn't have any kind of political benefit for South Korea. And then the second aspect of it is that as South Korea pursued an international strategy in terms of responding to the Chun'an, and relied on the alliance with the United States as the basis upon which to make that particular argument, that really backfired with China. And in fact, there's some aspects of the China discussion about this that really sees, you know, South Korea as the tail wagging the dog in terms of influencing the United States. And we all know that this, you know, it was transmuted into an issue in the U.S.-China relationship as well in the context of exercises. Another aspect of this particular incident I think that we can point to is that it really shows the limits of what South Korea can do in the context of providing some kind of regional leadership. To respond, because at least in this particular context, there was a real limit in terms of what South Korea was able to do in terms of being able to achieve its objectives. One of the results of this is that in the China-South Korea relationship, there is greater distrust now than there has been since normalization in 1992. And so all these issues suggest that the political and security aspects of the China-South Korea relationship are going to continue to be very difficult, I think, for both sides to manage, particularly in a context where there's not some kind of regional regulating mechanism. It also suggests that it's going to be difficult for, the alliance, in a way, is a background factor. The USROK alliance is a background factor that is influencing the China-South Korea, capacity to institutionalize. And so both of these issues, I think, are going to be very complicated in terms of what we can expect in terms of China-South Korea political and security management or management of political and security issues moving forward. I'm going to stop there because Fiona has already presented our conclusions, and we'll just move on to broader discussion.
At this point, we will be turning over the floor. We do have a couple microphones, and because this is an audio recording, I would just ask that you wait until you do have a microphone, and then state your name and your question. And since we already have one, Hyundong will come right up here. Right here. Yeah.
My name is Jay Kim, CPA and business consultant. How do you prospect the China-Korea FTA and its implication to the sensitive Kaesong area business operation?
Well, China and South Korea just started their first round of preliminary FTA talks this September after ending, I think, an almost four-year joint feasibility study that ended earlier this year, which led to an MOU on further discussions on sensitive issues. I guess the main opposition from South Korea is the agricultural and fisheries sector. There's a report showing that as a result of an FTA would cause the most serious losses to the agricultural sector, including a decline of production of up to 20% of 2005 levels. Whereas in the Chinese side, there's opposition from the export, the competitive export sectors that I already mentioned, like steel and chemicals. But I think there's been more support for South Korea recently for a China-Korea FTA in response to the recent Taiwan-China ECFA. I should also mention that progress in China-Korea FTA talks, however, is unlikely to progress without any progress in CORUS FTA talks. On the other hand, it might lead to, you know, it might catalyze more support for the CORUS FTA. And I think Scott can address the Kaesong issue.
I wish I could address the Kaesong issue, but I think that, in fact, it's really too early to be able to say precisely what the impact of a China-ROK FTA would be on Kaesong. You can imagine several different possibilities. You know, one might be that it could enable Chinese firms to become involved in Kaesong in some form in terms of providing some kind of investment or opportunity or participation. But it's hard to say whether that would really be attractive from a Chinese perspective, because maybe it's better for Chinese firms to just go bilateral in terms of working with North Korea. I'm not sure that the Kaesong issue would be as significant as a political issue in a China-ROK FTA compared to the politics of that particular issue in the context of a China, or in the context of the CORUS negotiation that took place a couple of years ago. It's an interesting question. It's actually the first time that I've heard that particular issue raised related to China-Korea FTA.
Thank you. Leo Bosner, private consultant. On the question of agriculture and food supplies, I'm kind of ignorant on this. How dependent is South Korea on food imports from China? That is, if the food imports from China were found to be seriously contaminated or even to be cut off for some reason, is that an inconvenience to Korea or is it a threat to the security of their food supply?
Well, the imports of contaminated Chinese food products is obviously a threat to Korea, as we saw in the kimchi cases that I just mentioned. Interestingly, Scott mentioned South Korea's kimchi deficit that it's going through right now, which caused it to ease restrictions on Chinese kimchi imports to make up for the gap within South Korea. So I think reports of or the scare about Chinese contaminated products are still it's not significant enough to induce any restrictions or easing of dependency on South Korean agricultural imports. Or maybe it just shows South Korea's heavy dependence on kimchi.
Yeah, I mean, what I would add is that I think South Korea is sufficiently integrated into the international economy in terms, including in the area of agricultural procurement, that it might have an impact. You know, that kind of scandal can have an impact on price of individual goods because it would mean reduced supply. There are probably very few agricultural goods, other than kimchi, that are critical necessities in the South Korean diet where there would be a significant impact. I mean, another aspect of this right now is, South Korea has this huge rice overproduction and problems, in fact, with storage of rice. And that, of course, is connected to, long-standing policies that attempt to be self-sufficient in rice production at the same time that the Korean diet has shifted towards less dependence on rice. And again, that's just evidence of the openness of the agricultural markets, globally, and which has had a direct impact on South Korean dietary preferences.
Yes, Dr.
Rosman. Gil Rosman. Gil Rosman, Princeton, and the Woodrow Wilson Center. The rare earth metal export ban from China, although not officially declared, must be a wake-up call to South Koreans. Having already experienced the garlic war escalation and more that you discussed, is there a sort of a set of fears or scenarios that South Koreans are considering where China would use economic pressure, having used it successfully before, and thinking South Korea is especially vulnerable, where that might be used for non-economic issues, whether it's the arrest of Chinese fishermen or the territorial dispute in the Yellow Sea or the West Sea, or other types of issues, military exercise with the United States. In other words, is there preparation and is there a calculation of what sorts of things China might use as leverage should it want to transform South Korea's foreign policy?
That's a very difficult question for me to answer, in part because even though I was just in South Korea last week, I didn't have conversations on that particular issue, and it's a very new issue. To a certain extent, I think that South Korea had put a lot of those issues aside with China's WTO entry. And in fact, one of the original premises underlying this particular paper was precisely, you know, that China's WTO entry had contributed to this particular framework for managing issues on the economic side that was absent in terms of any kind of political and security architecture. And to a certain extent, I think this rare earth metal case related to Japan, you know, opens that issue up in a way that is new and, you know, makes it, you know, a live issue again. I mean, one of the interesting, you know, aspects of the rare earth issue as, you know, from what I've gathered so far is that the Chinese apparently were cautious not to violate WTO regulations as they implemented that particular set of restrictions. They didn't announce a ban on any particular set of countries. They simply quietly halted or delayed, you know, exports to Japanese companies. I mean, in a way, it is kind of like the question of whether or not you cut off the oil spigot to North Korea. And I find it interesting that they would be willing to do that in the Japan case in that particular way. If I were in South Korea, I would begin to take a closer look at the possibility that there could be economic recriminations connected to political and security disputes. I think so far the overall strategy on the part of the South Koreans has really been to harness itself to the markets and essentially to trust in the markets and the possibility that diversification can you know, serve as the counterweight to overdependence. And the example that I would give there is related to South Korean investments. You know, South Korea had been a very heavy investor in China up until 2006. At which time it became an issue that over 40% of South Korean, you know, investments were going into China. And there became concerns about, you know, over-dependence in South Korea on the Chinese market. And subsequent to that, the proportion of investment in China, the investment in China as a proportion of South Korea's overall investment has declined. I think that that has been driven in part by this discussion in South Korea about concerns about dependence and essentially efforts to diversify. You've already listed some of the potential areas where you could imagine some kind of economic retaliatory response in connection with political issues, you know, by China. You know, another one that one might want to add onto the list would be related to the future of North Korea. But, you know, if you look in specific terms, I think that it's kind of hard to come up with specific measures that China would be able to take that would be, you know, effective. In a way, I think the rare earth metal issue was kind of a one-off kind of issue. And, you know, what I've also heard related to that sector, although I'm obviously not an expert, you know, in that sector, is that, you know, the reason why China controls, you know, exports in that particular sector is not because they have a monopoly on rare earths, but that other countries are not exporting at this stage. They're using their own rare earths to meet their own needs. And so it's not clear necessarily, you know, other than in that particular sector in relationship to a resource-poor country like Japan, and South Korea would also be in that group, you know, what are the, you know, other areas where China would be able to apply that kind of specific leverage, you know, in a particular dispute. You know, in the rare earth case, it suggests that the, you know, from a South Korean perspective in terms of the way they've been responding to this past pattern, you know, the answer would probably be diversification of sources and trying to establish agreements with other countries that have rare earth deposits regarding continuity of supply.
Right behind you. Oh, right behind me, sorry. Ernie Prieg, Manufacturers Alliance. I have a brief comment and a question more in the manufacturing sector, which may not surprise you. But I should say there is an article actually in The Economist this week about the kimchi war. If you've seen it, it says price has gone up 600% this year. But it doesn't put, it plays down the China connection. Just one sentence. It says a poor harvest brought on by bad weather was the original culprit, but with prices soaring, hoarding may also be responsible. There's some comment about China, but it's relatively minor. You might be interested in seeing this. But also more broadly in agriculture, and the three examples are very interesting, but they, the three of them added together were less than $500 million of Korean imports, whereas overall, as you can see, it's 70 or 80 billion. It's almost all in manufacturing. And this, and my common question is really a follow-on to what you're just saying about trade strategy, because two things have happened. One, in 2006, China put forward its indigenous innovation economic strategy, which was quite a radical shift to favor Chinese companies and sort of economic nationalism in a technological direction. And as, my most recent study, incidentally, was entitled India and China, an Advanced Technology Race, and how the U.S. should respond. And clearly, the Korean companies that I've been reading about in China, as America and other countries, have been feeling the squeeze on their profits and their also the intellectual property, a lot of concerns. And this is still just unfolding. This is a very comprehensive Chinese strategy. But then second is the 2009 very comprehensive free trade agreement, free trade investment agreement with India, which Korean industry was very much in favor of, and where they don't feel threatened about their IPR or their investment is quite welcome and going well, which fits in with the strategy of diversifying, certainly. But I wonder if you had any comment about just how serious the Koreans' manufacturing exporters to China are about the indigenous innovation strategy, if that's the official title, and also how positive they see the India market as a place to go and invest, joint ventures, exports growing there 20-30% a year, and how does this fit into their overall diversification strategy or whatever the trade strategy is more broadly? Thank you.
I can't comment in specific terms on the Korea-India economic relationship, but I think the best evidence of the diversification strategy is really related to the vigor with which South Koreans have been pursuing FTAs really only since about 2005. The one that was in the news last week, obviously, is the Korea-EU FTA. Clearly, South Korea sees its future as connected to the global economy. On the indigenous innovation, question, I actually asked that question last week to a colleague I was meeting from Samsung. Obviously they have huge investments, in China and are affected by potentially by Chinese competition. But, he gave, an answer that I liked, and that was, it just means that we have to work harder in order to innovate technologically. But he did cite the level of R&D that Chinese are putting into development of new technologies as an issue of concern. And I think there is a concern, that he expressed that South Korea wouldn't be able to compete with that, over the long term. So I think they're watching it closely.
China's, as you mentioned, indigenous innovation strategy is clearly a threat to South Korea. In terms of the inevitable challenges that accompany their as their trade relationship evolves, and with the convergence of the two structures of the economy, and as Scott mentioned, South Korea realizes this and is emphasizing new areas of future trades that that remain untapped, such as green energy and renewable energy and high technology, and this has been the focus of new South Korean, very recent initiatives in South Korea, to boost the bilateral trade and investment relationship through the, for example, the recent establishment of the China desk with the KOTRA, the Korean Trade Investment Agency, in the including both Shanghai and Seoul branches.
My name is Brent Choi from the VOA Voice of America. I have two questions. One is that, could you elaborate a little bit about the Cheonanam incident, and did South Korea try to use its leverage to, its economic leverage to Beijing, and why Beijing, well, it did not work, why Beijing rejected? My second question is that you emphasize the importance of the institutional mechanism. What kind of institutional mechanism you keep in mind? Could you elaborate a little bit?
Actually, I don't think that the South Koreans necessarily used economic leverage with Beijing so much as they thought they had a lot more leverage than North Korea did. You know, they basically looked at the economic relationship between China and South Korea and the economic relationship between China and North Korea and felt on that basis that China would be a lot closer to South Korea in its response to the Cheonan incident than to North Korea. But China looks at it from a different perspective, clearly. You know, China looked at it, with reference to their traditional historical relationship, their geopolitical, interest in maintaining stability, their concern that the South Korean response and the internationalization of the response might actually heighten the potential for conflict, and their own desire to try to maintain some kind of influence with North Korea, and their concern that essentially, if they backed South Korea on the China incident, the North Koreans would look at it as a further betrayal, and would, as a result, that would damage China's own ability to try to manage North Korea. Such as, it's debatable whether they've been effective in doing that, but, there, I think, was a perception that, China's leverage or capacity to influence North Korea would be even more greatly reduced. And so I just mentioned that because, some past work that I've done has been focused on China's perception of its ability to use economic leverage vis-a-vis North and South Korea. So I just found it interesting that in this particular case, the South Koreans started from the perception that it had economic leverage that it could use really vis-a-vis North Korea, but with Beijing. And that turned out to be not the case. In terms of institutional mechanisms, in specific terms, one could imagine a more effective China or more well-developed set of coordinating institutions between South Korea and Beijing on the political and security side as one possible vehicle by which to manage specific disputes. Xi Wan pointed out that on the economic side, there was a lot of cooperation post Kimchi dispute, between the health agencies in South Korea and China. But we didn't see Koguryo or the Cheonan, incident yet having any kind of impact in terms of greater bilateral institutional management of potential future disputes. There were no studies about crisis management post Koguryo between China and South Korea. Whereas, between the U.S. and China, post-EP3 incident, there were all sorts of studies on crisis management. So, why is it that that hasn't happened in the China-South Korea case? The second aspect is kind of regional, and it's really, this issue which, keeps on coming back of, wouldn't it be... wouldn't it provide greater certainty if there were some kind of regional framework through which it were possible to to regulate political and security relations or reinforce the idea that there are vehicles by which to manage political disputes in Northeast Asia. Other regions have that kind of framework, but obviously Northeast Asia doesn't. And so, you know, essentially the argument is essentially that in the absence of that kind of structure and the absence of a willingness by parties to participate in that kind of structure, it's going to be more difficult to manage bilateral disputes on the political and security side as a result of the absence of that type of structure. You know, incidentally, we can look at ASEAN just as a kind of example. Xiwen and I were talking about this morning, and the South China Sea issue. And ASEAN, at least, is a regional framework. It just so happens that China wants to, other than agreeing on a code of conduct, wants to deal with each country bilaterally in terms of dealing with the, you know, specifics of the South China Sea disputes. So, you know, in Northeast Asia's case, there are actually two pieces that are missing. You know, one is the framework and the other is the political will. In South China Sea area, you have a framework, you just have an absence of political will. So, you know, those are the two, in a way, those are the two specific ingredients that we are pointing to, you know, as missing, you know, that, you know, suggests that it's going to be much harder to manage potential frictions in China-South Korea political relations going forward than it might otherwise have to be.
Sure. Well, with regard to the regional security institutions, I think it's also important to note three constraints on South Koreans' willingness to play a stronger leadership role with regard to regional security institutions, as Scott mentioned in his presentation. The first being just the traditional perception of the U.S.-Korea alliance as being the center of South Korea's security policy. Which comes into conflict with Chinese perceptions. China sees the alliance system and security institutions in zero-sum terms, which constrains sort of joint participation within a regional security framework. And second is the domestic divisions within South Korea with regard to aligning with China versus the U.S. And I guess third is just remaining domestic uncertainties within South Korea about South Korea's new global responsibilities. And I guess lastly, one promising area, or it's hard to say since it's too early, is the trilateral summit between China, Japan, South Korea, which was only launched in 2008, and they've had three annual meetings so far. The most recent one earlier this May, I think, produced, I think Scott briefly mentioned, it was a blueprint, I think 10-year cooperation agreement, a very comprehensive. So in this case, it doesn't focus specifically on security issues since it's broadly based on economics and cultural and education and broader areas. But at the same time, they agreed to establish a permanent secretariat in Seoul from 2011, which might serve as the needed central coordinating mechanism for the existing trilateral meetings that already exist. At the same time, the three countries have had these meetings, you know, within the ASEAN plus three context since 1999. So one risk is for these summits to be primarily economically driven, as the existing ones have been.
I'm sorry I missed the beginning, so I might ask you a question that you already discussed. My name is Ahmed Mir. I used to handle U.S.-Korea science issues in 1999. It seems to me that the context of this should really be U.S.-China relations and Japan-China relations, and secondly, scientifically and technologically, I think South Korea is more or less a frontier technological nation at the same levels as practically the United States and some of the advanced countries. And so I see South Korea as being in essentially the same boat as the United States and others like Japan. And I see this mixing of economic issues with security issues complicated, if nothing else. I mean, I think the economic issues such as South Korea expanding itself in terms of working in countries like India and so on is the natural outgrowth of the increasing preeminence of South Korea's technological capabilities on one side and the growth in other countries all along the Far East. So what I find is that I get a sense, maybe it's wrong, that we are focusing too much on thinking that China-South Korea's trade would be impacted by these security issues and China's sort of foreign policy more than I think I expect. Thank you. You might want to tell me how wrong I am.
Well, I mean, not to repeat necessarily. Well, yes, I guess to repeat. I mean, what we were really, you know, doing was trying to take a look at, you know, what has happened in the economic relationship, especially as it relates to capacities to manage an increasingly complicated economic relationship, and ask the question why or whether there could be a similar development in the bilateral security relationship. We weren't necessarily trying to make any argument that about the relationship between trade and politics in this particular exercise.
Hi, my name is Matt Schauer. I come from the State Department. I was curious if I read this morning that South Korea is building, or they're going to start building refugee camps in preparation for the power transition. Just they're expecting chaos in the midst of the power transition. And I was curious if China had any preparation as well, economically, if they're going to be building infrastructure or anything, what their perception of the, you know, Kim Jong-il giving power to his son, what his perception, what their perception is. Are they excited for a new leader? Are they worried for a rookie? You know, kind of what their perception is and what they're doing in preparation for that. So if you could just answer real quick, that would be nice.
You know, I don't have a recent reference point necessarily. Certainly, you know, since Kim Jong-un has taken, well, actually, he hasn't taken power yet. Since he's emerged, since we have a picture of him, I haven't seen any or heard any particular comments from Chinese colleagues on how that has changed their strategy. You know, my prior experience has been that if you ask Chinese colleagues about, you know, concerns about instability in North Korea, you know, their response, at least to Americans, is don't worry. And I presume that's because they're, you know, doing enough worrying to take care of both of us. But I think that the Chinese focus is on trying to maintain stability. It's been very clear from Hu Jintao's statements in response to the party conference that China is welcoming the new leadership. They haven't mentioned any specific names, interestingly enough. But I think that from a Chinese perspective, the revival of the party institutions is seen as a positive thing. With regard to Chinese preparations for instability, I'm sure that they have their own studies and their own ideas about how to respond to that particular type of situation. My own feeling is that the recent responses to various crises, earthquakes, etc., in China, has probably increased China's own confidence in terms of its capacity to be able to manage crisis response in a generic sense. They've also had refugees from Myanmar coming within the past year. And so all those experiences, I think, make China less concerned about whether or not they would be able to manage a response to instability. You know, the last thing I'll say on this is that although, you know, the comments of the first son this morning were also very interesting, I don't, when I asked last week about prospects for instability in North Korea, you know, to some of my South Korean colleagues, you know, generally speaking, there is not a high level of concern about immediate prospects for instability right now in North Korea. That was their take. I don't know if they're right. I tried to ask people I thought would have a good sense of that.
I'm not sure about Chinese plans to, the recent report that you just mentioned about Chinese plans to build refugee camps along the border, but I think whenever a major thing happens in North Korea, there's always a lot of hype in the South Korean media, especially about potential changes along the border that could signal some sort of preparation. But I think the PLA has been doing some planning over the past few years on humanitarian responses. But this is what is lacking is any sort of joint plan with South Korea or the United States with regard to refugees or a humanitarian crisis resulting from a potential collapse in North Korea. And as Scott mentioned, China seems to have a strong sort of crisis management plans in response to its own domestic events like the earthquake, the recent earthquake last year, I think, or 2 years ago.
I'd like to jump in here and ask what your perspectives are on the role South Korean public sentiment or public awareness has played in specifically in maybe resistance in the ROK for more cooperation with PRC or any sort of mistrust. And if we could put it in, you know, layman U.S.-centric terms, you know, do the kimchi wars or the melamine scandal compare it all to the beef issue with the United States? And or was it easy for ROK government to lift restrictions on Chinese kimchi because there was a need? Was there any public lashback or just more on how the public in South Korea has or has not played a role in the trade relationship/security relationship
and any friction within two countries? Well, we mentioned this or we discussed this in our paper, but I think the Goguryeo dispute in 2005 marked the turning point in South Korean public perceptions of China. And I guess to answer your question briefly, public perceptions do play a major role in South Korea in terms of South Korea's policy towards China compared to, for example, in China, the Goguryeo case was rarely, you know, mentioned in the, covered in the media when it first emerged in 2004. I think, as I already mentioned before, it's South Korean public perceptions of China appear to be sort of inversely tied to the U.S. since there's the perception of the U.S. versus China in zero-sum terms, and I think that's the challenge to overcome when it comes to balancing its South Korea's partnership with China on the one hand and U.S.-ROK alliance on the other. One approach would be to strengthen South Korea's multilateral approach or global Korea to positively engage both South Korea and the U.S. in multilateral settings.
Did kimchi or melamine compare to the Goguryeo incident, or did they just compound with each other? Were they treated separately by South Korea's public?
They compounded in terms of, there were separate events, but for example, in recent, the Olympic torch relay in Seoul, the Koguryo issue came up, and broader sort of South Korean protests about Chinese human rights issues. And then the Koguryo issue, you know, came up during the Winter Olympics in 2007 as well. And even most recently during the World Cup soccer games, I think there was some controversy over some kimchi ad that sparked something, a response in both in China and South Korea. So I think these past incidents in the past, especially highlighted by the garlic and the kimchi and the Koguryo cases, do sort of represent sort of the ongoing, recurring political and historical problems between South Korea and China in terms of public perceptions.
Let me just say, my perception is that actually the South Korean public has not politicized recent economic disputes. The melamine scandal was treated, you know, as a kind of scandal, but it didn't become a political issue affecting the relationship between the two countries. You know, in contrast to Koguryo and Chun'an, which had major impact on South Korean public opinion of China. I also think that South Korean public seems to, if we look at some of the food issues compared to the US beef issue, it suggests to me that the South Korean public handles its issues related to China and the United States differently. And in an odd sort of way, one almost gets the impression that you know, because they're different systems, the South Korean people are more likely, if they are concerned about a China-related issue, not to necessarily be so vocal or on the streets. Whereas it seems that, you know, with issues related to the United States, there's a different kind of response, or maybe it's a different strategy, you know, depending on how you look at it.
To join me in thanking our authors, but before we do, a quick note that our next paper will be on November 16th, and that will be about investment opportunities and economic engagement with North Korean entities by Dr. Kevin Shepherd of CSIS Pacific Forum in Hawaii. And then following that in December, we have two Eurasia Group authors writing on green energy in Northeast Asia for us. And we will have that date finalized this week. I think those are my announcements. So we have lots of food if anybody is still hungry. And with that,